Superbrain is a labour of love. Alas, no podcast can survive on love alone. We don't have a sponsor, so we need your support for Superbrain to stay alive and kicking. You can make a one-off donation by following the Support This Show link in the show or episode description.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
My name is Sabina Brennan, and you are listening to Superbrain, the podcast for everyone with a brain. My guest this week is Dr. Rupi Ujala, NHS doctor, best-selling author, and host of the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. Rupi is passionate about lifestyle medicine and is on a mission to help people use food as medicine and a recipe for health. Rupi shares his personal health journey, explaining how, prompted by his mum and a devastating diagnosis, he changed his diet and lifestyle and not only avoided serious heart surgery, but also reversed his heart condition. Rupi, the picture of health despite a hectic schedule, endearingly admits that sometimes he fails to follow his own advice.
Tell me about it.
But never fails to do three things every day that help him to survive tough and stressful times. Keep listening to find out what they are.
There's so many things I want to talk to you about. I want to make sure that I get the app stuff in at the top. So your app, so exciting. I downloaded it and I got the lovely folks. You can actually get a 7-day free trial, which is a fantastic way to do it.
Yeah.
Also on top of that, sign up and get a little email of some fab recipes for 14 days. And they absolutely look delicious.
Oh, great.
They really do. And so healthy.
Thank you so much. It's been a long journey to get to this point, actually. I had this idea of creating the Headspace for Healthy Eating about 2.5-3 years ago, where I was just trying to figure out, okay, how do we help people eat well every day? And so we actually invited about 15 people to come to my kitchen studio a couple of years ago. We interviewed them about what the barriers to healthy eating were, how they engaged with recipes, what they preferred. Was it video recipes or step-by-step? You know, how they actually meal planned, if they meal planned at all, how many people in their household. Like, we did a real deep dive with individuals for about an hour each. And then we started mocking up some ideas about what this platform could look like. You know, was it going to be a course? Was it going to be something that you do on your desktop? We had a whole bunch of different ideas about what this could be. And then we came to the simplest solution, which was a recipe library that you have on your app. We'll eventually have it on iPad and desktop as well as Android, but right now it's just on the iPhone. And with the addition of the fact that you can also filter according to health goals. So what me and my research team have done, I've looked through hundreds, if not thousands of papers on nutritional medicine, looking at specific areas like skin health, brain health, mental health, cardiovascular health, general well-being, inflammation.
And I have to jump in there and say, I was so delighted to see that, that you had brain health in there, because as you know, that's what I'm passionate about. Particularly when it comes to eating, you know, rubbish in, rubbish out, and people often don't think of their brain. So I was really pleased to see that section. But I think that's also really, really smart way to do it, you know, what people's goals are. So many diet apps, diet books, things that you can sign up for are totally focused on weight loss.
Yes.
You know, on the aesthetics. I mean, yes, some of them will say it's weight loss for health, which is great. But most of us, and most of us, are driven by the aesthetics. Yeah. That's just part of being human. You know, anyone who has had any sort of chronic health condition, or anyone who's even just going through things like menopause, etc., they want to do everything they can to minimize the symptoms. And like that, something like diet.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to ask you. So when you say we, who's we? Because I often wonder about that. Actually, yeah. 4 o'clock this morning,
yeah,
my husband woke up. He couldn't sleep. I wasn't sleeping with my migraines. And we ended up chatting. And, you know, we're talking about our day. And yeah. I, you know, who are you interviewing? He said, and I told him, he said, oh, will you ask? He says, is that the really good looking chap? And I said, yes, it is. I said, he's a great advertisement for his lifestyle. And he said, yeah, his lifestyle. He said, would you ever ask him, how does he do it all? Yeah. Like, how does he do it all? How does he fit everything in?
I know. Sometimes I feel like a bit of a fraud, because the many times where I have to remind myself, you know, you really do need to practice what you preach, because particularly over the last couple of months, bringing the app to launch, I was doing 16-hour days. I was working at the weekend. I was working well after 6 p.m. every day, which is my sort of designated hard cutoff for looking at my screen. So I was doing everything wrong, and I'm still trying to figure out like how I actually do it whilst looking after my well-being as well. So in the spirit of transparency, I think it's important to be honest about, okay, right now it's hard.
Do you know what? You have really just made my day, because I've been really struggling, and it is very hard when you're giving advice, lifestyle advice. And last year was a really tough year for me. Now, I know what you're going through, because in 2012, I developed a brain health app, knew nothing about app development, the exact same as you. We did the same sort of thing as you. We actually brought people in, and we even showed them aesthetics. And, you know, because 2012, that's 10 years ago now. So even the whole app thing. And we were also aiming at a slightly older audience. And what would work, what wouldn't work. And I know the sleepless nights. I actually think I managed at that period in time. It was when I was developing Hello Brain. I thought I was really brilliant, because I'd figured out how to fit two working days into one. So I would work just the normal day, and then I would go to bed maybe about 10 or 11, sleep, wake up at 3, work again till 6. Yeah. You know what I mean? And get it. It was the only way I fitted everything in. I'd committed to so many things. But I'm the same as you. Last year was a stressful year for me. Early part of the year was brilliant. If I look at the time, even I was on your podcast last May for the launch of my book, I was in really good shape body wise, you know, physically, mentally, etc. Within months, I gained 2 stone and was really sort of unwell and got COVID myself. I mean, my son, who's also a GP, well, he actually got a parasite and really life threatening. He's immune compromised. So he almost died. So that was pretty stressful. Then he got COVID 10 days later. Then I got COVID. Then for the whole year, I had my house on the market, selling my house, you know, all those stressful things at once. And I just, like that, you feel like a fraud. I'm giving talks on how to manage stress, and I'm struggling. But I'm struggling myself. But I think that helps to understand how other people are coping.
Exactly. I think it's that lived experience. I mean, it sounds like you've had a roller coaster of a year, and unless you can actually live it yourself, it's hard to talk to other people about it, which is, you know, even as a GP, I can only empathize so much with someone who is going through, I don't know, a terminal illness or depression or, you know, lack of motivation to improve their weight, you know, or quitting smoking, for example. There's only so much you can empathize with. And I think that lived experience just allows you to connect deeper with the people that you're trying to influence. So yeah, in the spirit of honesty, it's like, it is tough to do all these different things. I do have a few things that anchor me though. I always meditate in the morning.
Right.
I always do my affirmations in the morning as well, where I remind myself of why I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm literally constantly talking to myself and say, Rupi, you're doing a very challenging thing. You will get through it.
Okay.
If you just persist and you're consistent, you will get through it. And it's just training my brain with those positive signals that will sit in the subconscious as well as conscious mind, that will allow me to hopefully get through this. So little things like that, if you can anchor yourself with small, tangible, short snippets of positive affirmation, I think that's been very good for my mental well-being as well during this time.
I find once my sleep is disrupted, like I'm just screwed up. And I'm sure a lot of people listening get that. And a lot of people have had, if the data on prescription of sleeping tablets is anything to go by, there's been a huge increase in insomnia, mainly down to the pandemic. But I know myself, once my sleep is disrupted, I am completely derailed, and I do have sort of post-COVID insomnia with it. I really am experiencing poor sleep, disrupted sleep that I haven't had for a long time, that I would have occasionally, as we all do, but it's when it's persistent. And I think what a lot of people aren't aware, or certainly are surprised when I talk about it again, when I give my sleep, how you can have promote good sleep as she is struggling to sleep herself. But you do have to remind yourself of those things. But the thing when the relationship between sleep and stress is important there. But I think what people aren't aware of is often people, if you have disrupted sleep, you are likely to eat somewhere between 300 and 600 more calories the next day, and you will crave calories. You will seek calories from sugar and fatty foods. So you just go into this vicious cycle. And weight gain, like just sleep loss, within a year, you can gain 10 pounds just from the sleep loss.
You know, I totally resonate with that, because as someone who is very fastidious about their sleep, when I don't have good sleep, I definitely feel it the next day. But there's two things that I do that I think would be useful for people to hear about. A is sympathize with myself. So I have quite a structured diary where, like, literally every 45 minutes is pretty much assigned to a task.
But therein, can I just say that? I hate to interrupt you, but that's a really key point.
Yeah.
You said every 45 minutes, not every 60 minutes. So you're allowing a little break in between.
Yeah.
That's critical for people.
Yeah.
But you see, that's another thing that will really help.
Yeah, absolutely. So everything is quite regimented. But if I've had poor sleep, I look at I use an Oura Ring, or you can use free apps and stuff on your phone. If I know that my sleep isn't on point, I will sympathize with myself a lot more. I will quite happily move things around my schedule just because I know I'm not going to be up to my optimum. So I'm not going to try and push myself to do that exercise thing in the morning. I'm not going to push myself to do 5-6 tasks. I'm going to be, you know, naturally just say, okay, I'm just going to do 3 today. That's what I'm going to do. And the other thing is exactly what you just said about the craving of food. When you know that's your sleep deprivation kicking in, that will make you crave. I know to be a little bit more regimented with my eating habits. Like, I'm feeling hungry right now. I'm not going to just go for something that I know is in the kitchen. I'm going to eat in the morning or the afternoon. I'm going to eat in the evening. And those are the other two things I'm going to do, because I know it's my brain tricking me into thinking that it's trying to seek sugary foods to fuel a poorly functioning brain. That's basically what's happening.
Also, as well, you talk, and you have it in your app as well, and you've talked about it in a lot of your interviews, the importance of gut health. And I actually wrote about it in my book as well, you know, that cravings often come from your gut through the neurons. You know, your second brain is your gut. Mm. And essentially, it's your bad microbe saying, give me more of that shit. I'm on a roll here. I can take advantage of the fact that you didn't sleep last night, and I can get you craving more and more and more of these things.
Yeah.
So, and I do think, I suppose that's my whole principle as well, and yours too, in a way, that by handing people knowledge, you give them power and understanding, rather than when people are just told, do this, do that, do the other. I think it helps if you kind of understand what's going on
inside.
So fantastic that you've brought your app to fruition. I know how hard that is and what a challenge it really is. And I know we did it. I don't know about you, but we certainly did it on very limited budget. I got some funding from the European Commission, and apps are very expensive.
Yeah, they are.
If you want to do, I mean, I had to pull mine right back. I'm sure you were the same.
Yeah.
Oh, I want people to be able to put in, I'm this, I'm that, I don't like this food, I don't like that food, and get what they want. And they kind of go, how much money have you got?
yeah, totally. It was that sort of iterative process over the last 2 years. I mean, I spent a long time, and it was quite an expensive process finding the right developers, because I'm non-technical myself.
Yes.
And then once having the developers, it was like that. It was like, okay, these are all the things that I really want to launch with, but actually we're gonna have to strip back everything, including the Android version, because of lack of funds, because I bootstrapped the whole thing. And that has really allowed us to launch with what I feel is a simple product, but it's still very, very useful for a lot of people based on the feedback. And so, you know, the fact that you can filter according to health goals, and myself and the research team have looked at all those studies and looked at the dietary patterns, as well as the specific ingredients that align with those health goals. And then you can also filter according to your dietary preferences, as well as allergens and intolerances. And they get access to this wonderful, rich content library with all those recipes with step-by-step images. The whole thing just evokes colorful playfulness around healthy eating rather than what most people are used to, which is a regimented dietary sort of
restriction, punishment.
Yeah,
and that did jump out at me. I mean, the food just looks delicious. And actually, you say simple there. Now, I do think from a user perspective, simple is best, because I know, say, I try to use, for example, first thing you do if you have migraine, you go to a neurologist and they say, keep a diary. Now, I had so many headaches of different kinds all day, every day, that to try and keep a diary, I could do nothing else, because I could wake with one kind of headache at 11 o'clock. I could get a massive ice pick one here, then I might be okay for an hour, and then I kind of get a different one. So the migraine app actually just irritated me, you know, and then actually, which was really interesting, my neurologist flipped it. He just said, just write when you don't have migraines, you know, and that was just so much easier, you know, and you discover, well, I never have migraine 3 days, you know, I might have a free hour or whatever. So for me, say with migraine, the point was to get it down to where it was bearable and I can just continue doing, because the brain is wonderful and people with chronic illnesses do adapt to what they have. And that's probably part of the problem in a way as well, is you adapt to having these things. So you don't realize that actually making lifestyle changes and changing your diet, for example, could actually really improve that. And I mean, I know myself as well, like, why that's why I say I have headaches every day. I do know if I have proper sleep, I do know if I exercise, I do know if I eat properly, they're not so bad. And that's kind of a message.
It's amazing, isn't it, like how multifactorial different lifestyle changes and nutrition can be when it comes to chronic disease in particular. I mean, like, you know, just making small tweaks and changes to some of my patients over the last, you know, 10 years I've been working, have been pretty groundbreaking. And, you know, it sounds very simple on the surface, but when you understand the potential mechanisms, like, you know, we were just talking about microbes and their role in appetite, for example, and, and inflammation, and looking after the integrity of the gut barrier, which can have a profound impact on a number of different things. You know, those little tweaks and changes can be absolutely groundbreaking. And, you know, sometimes I sound like it's quite easy to do these things, and we have to be respectful of everyone's different abilities and conveniences in their environment and stuff. But if we can deliver the information and give them tangible, realistic goals, it is possible to have vast improvements in a number of symptoms and improved performance as well. It's not just about the absence of symptoms. It's also about improving performance.
Yeah, that's something I want to jump in on you, because I want to scream about this, you know, and you actually work in the NHS. But I mean, I've been talking about this for years and years and years, particularly in the context, say, of dementia, which was where I originally started working, is how little money is spent on prevention and how all our funds, it's just stupid. I'm sorry. It's just plain stupid. Why invest all that money in, like, I think in Ireland, it's something like 60% of hospital beds. This is pre-COVID, folks, because everything changed with COVID in that regard. But pre-COVID, 60% of hospital beds are taken up by chronic illnesses, which for the most part are lifestyle induced, in that they're modifiable, they could be prevented, etc. Now, folks, like, a lot of people can get angry, and I've had people come up to me sometimes after talks and saying, oh, you're blaming the person for the disease. No, it's nothing to do with blame. This is to do with prevention, with actually letting people know that actually what we do during our life influences how your body, your brain, your gut, how everything works. And actually, that's empowering. So whilst on the one hand, we need to treat the people who are currently affected by chronic illnesses, I'm in there, you know, with chronic migraine. And also, like, my mother died of and with dementia. Now, she didn't know all the stuff that could have helped prevent dementia. So, you know, it's not her fault. We still need to treat her. But it seems to me really stupid, given all that we know about prevention, particularly through lifestyle, that we're putting all the money on treating a cohort while we're actually letting another cohort come through. Do you know, you got to start putting more and more money into prevention and into education, because so much of it starts in childhood. And I look, the obesity in childhood is, it's horrifying.
Yeah, I have thoughts on this. So I totally agree. In terms of preventative medicine, we don't spend anywhere near as much money as we should do. So what we have is essentially a reactive model of healthcare rather than a proactive model. There are some changes being made to that, but I think, you know, whenever you're fighting fires, your resources are always going to go to the front line without really that lateral thinking about, okay, how do we prevent the next generation of suffering with the same issues? And a lot of that comes down to the environment in which we live in as well. So the idea of lifestyle medicine is sometimes, like you said, there was people coming up to you and accusing you of assigning blame to the patient. The whole lifestyle medicine element sounds like it's always going to be a patient choice issue, whereas in reality, it's part patient choice, but a lot of it, of your ability to prevent disease, is down to your environment, your educational level, yes, your cooking ability, finances, yep, a whole bunch of other external drivers to lifestyle. And I think that's where we as a community need to be a lot more vocal about it. And so, you know, talking about these issues and also giving people as much information as possible, tangible changes that they can make, is the way we're going to get up this. And that's one of the reasons why I do the podcast and the socials and the books and stuff. But it's also one of the reasons why I did the app, because I feel that that's a way to scale up this information and make it achievable to eat well every day.
Yes. And I think you're so on the money there. And there's so many important things that you said in there, because socioeconomic status is hugely predictive of so many illnesses and conditions. And a lot of that is to do with education, access. It's also generational, unfortunately, you know, because you talk a lot about your mom and your mom's influence and, you know, cooking and all that. So that's why I think there has to be a role for other people, because, and I've said this as well, and I feel strongly about this, that your education system is different to ours, but I don't think there's enough life education in our educational systems. Kids should be taught how to cook. Kids should be taught about nutrition. They should be taught about managing finances, money, you know, about taking loans, about how if you borrow, that's actually you're going to pay three times for the thing, better to save. All those things, because they're generational, and that's what keeps people locked in, you know, environments that where they increase the risk of diseases and not getting through educational systems and all sorts of things. So I think there has to be a point where governments, people, I'm all for saying to people, we must take more responsibility for our health, because certainly in our country, I go somewhere along the line, the vast majority of the population abdicated responsibility for their health to the NHS or the HSE. No, you need to fix me. What can you give me? Whereas actually, ultimately, fundamentally, primarily, responsibility for your health rests with you. Now, that's fine to say if I'm in a position to have that knowledge and experience, that it's not a level playing field. And that is part of the problem, is that people with higher levels of education and better playing jobs have access to that information. And so they can actually look after their health better. So we need to level the playing field. And the only way to do that is by intervening and giving that education and giving that kind of empowerment. But I also think there's ways that governments can intervene. I think that it is wrong. I look at supermarket trolleys a lot. If I, you know, if I am shopping, my husband does most of the shopping. He's listening and he'll say, when are you in the supermarket? But when I am, I do look at the supermarket trolleys, and you will see people who have clear health issues and their trolleys are piled high with rubbish, just rubbish. And that's because that rubbish is cheap. And the fact of the matter actually is, really, vegetables and those kind of things are probably the cheapest food you can buy. Like, it is far cheaper to buy the ingredients for a vegetable curry or something like that than it is to buy the sealed up pre-made pack that's full of preservatives, etc. Right. I have so many things I want to talk to you. I want to go back to, this podcast is about surviving and thriving in life, ultimately. And you are a classic case of thriving, really. And I love your honesty that, you know, I often think of myself sometimes, and I think these kind of video links where you're only seen from the top, you know, yes, because people have said to me, oh, I saw you on the telly and you look fantastic, and I feel really shite, and actually you can't see the weight gain from here down, and I'm sitting back far to kind of disguise that. But I always have this sense of, you know, madly paddling underneath what people can see on the surface. And plus, on the surface, when you're doing something like this, for any people who are in the public eye, you get a surge of adrenaline, and that actually helps you. It's like actors on a stage. They could have a horrific chest infection and they can do an entire hour and a half performance and not cough once.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, it's suppressed, and you kind of get through that, whatever that threat or challenge is. But you'll really pay for it afterwards. So I also want to talk about the surviving bit, because I think everybody Even the most successful people on the planet have had some sort of challenge, and they have, and often it's because they've had that challenge that then they thrive. And in a way, that's exactly what's happened with you. So tell us a little bit about, you're 24.
Yeah.
You're just qualified as a doctor. You have all the stresses that go with that. And I know that having lived with a son, you know, doing those nights, that's just not really good for your health.
Yeah.
And you think maybe you're starting to get some panic attacks. So talk us a little bit through about what you were feeling.
Yeah. So back in 2009, when I just qualified, I was working at Basildon Hospital. So I was 3 months into the job, and no pre-existing issues. I didn't have any weight problems. I didn't have any family history or anything. And one day I was at the nurse's station and I started getting palpitations, and it came out of nowhere. I was sat down at the time, you know, it was a long stretch of long shifts that I was on. I was probably on my 9th or 10th day, something like that. And I let it go on for about 5 minutes until I spoke to my registrar and I said, look, would you mind feeling my pulse? I feel like I'm going a bit fast. And I was embarrassed at that point because I didn't know whether it was a panic attack or whether it was just like me not having enough water or whatever. Anyway, she felt my pulse. And then straight away, she got an ECG. And then within half an hour, stripped of my clothes, put into a hospital gown, hooked up to a cardiac monitor. And what it showed was barn door atrial fibrillation, which is a heart rhythm where your heart beats exceptionally irregularly. And in my case, very, very fast. So I was going above 200 beats per minute.
And normal would be?
Normal would be anything below 100, really. Yeah. So we classify normal as 60 to 100, even though I personally don't think that above 80 is particularly healthy if you're at rest, but this is a whole nother conversation.
Yeah.
So I was admitted, and I luckily didn't have low blood pressure. I didn't have to have a cardioversion or anything like that. I was just monitored overnight, and I was given some medications that reverted my rhythm. And I thought that was just going to be a one-off event. But what happened is I would go on to have these events 2 to 3 times a week, no triggers, no issues in my bloods. I had all the different studies, electrophysiology studies. I saw a number of different cardiologists. No one could figure out what the triggers were. And I was essentially told that I need to have an ablation, which is where you put a guide wire into an area around the heart, and you burn an area where there are misfiring cells that are causing this erroneous rhythm.
I think ablation is a word that doesn't really get through to what's involved.
Yeah.
You know, it is burning away. Yeah. Like, you know, there will be a smell of burning in the room.
Yes. I mean, luckily I didn't have to go through with that, because my mum really said to me, she's not a medic. She's just got her matriarchal Indian hat on. And everyone from an Indian family has sort of an Ayurvedic streak to everything, whether it's, you know, turmeric here, garam masala there, certain types of oils, head massages, all that kind of stuff. And she was
give me head massages. No. I must, if ever I became a millionaire, that is what I would invest in, is
totally
head massages or a massage, even, you know, the head massages are the very best. Sometimes I think it's the only reason I go to get my hair done. Yeah. To give a little one at the sink, and I'm going to want to go, would it be creepy to say, can you do another bit?
Another minute. I know, they're great. So she was like, you know, you really need to look at your diet and lifestyle before you entertain a more aggressive procedure. Yeah. And so, you know, really to appease her, because if I think about my mindset as a 24-year-old who, you know, straight out of medical school, being told by a number of different senior doctors, this is what you need to have. Who am I to go against that? And I wasn't going against that at all, but I'm glad that I listened to my mom, because after about 12 to 18 months of changes, my AF episodes reverted. And if I look back to my lifestyle, when I started having the issues, I was eating cereals and juice in the morning. I was having sandwiches in the afternoon, whatever the hospital canteen was serving up. I was having a quick pasta in the evening. I was having, quote unquote, a normal diet for a junior doctor. It's very, very normal if you think about what people are eating today.
I think it's a very normal diet for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
100%. You know, and it's a kind of, in a way, a convenience diet.
Oh,
and
yeah.
People, you know, you do think you're cooking for yourself if you make that sandwich, if you make that pasta, you know, even self-care. If it's got lovely, healthy sauces on
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And when you're a doctor like that, it's tough not to, like, you're on the go. It's kind of part of the job, isn't it? Oh, I have to just grab a quick sandwich. Totally. And a lot of us kind of feel like that. I don't have the time.
It's part of the bravado. It's like, I didn't have time to eat. I'm so good. I'm seeing all these patients. You know, there's a sort of an accolade behind the busyness of it all.
Except that your patients are going to suffer as a consequence because you won't be able to think properly.
Yeah, and myself. And so, you know, I wasn't sleeping properly. I was doing night shifts. I was stressed out my mind. I was working in a new job, you know, all these different things compounded. And for me, my threshold of disease was clearly a lot lower than my colleagues who, you know, didn't have any issues. And actually, I look back on it and I'm kind of grateful because it was like the canary in the coal mine sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people go through life for decades before it culminates in something really serious, like a heart attack or a stroke. Or,
I mean, it's something I feel very strongly about, again, also in the medical profession. You know, even my own experience, when you go to the doctor, the primary aim of the doctor when you go with multiple, even singular symptoms, due to your training, your primary concern is to rule out the most serious one.
Yeah.
And that makes sense, I suppose, and makes sense from so many levels. But death is not the only outcome. We are going to be suffering for a very long period because death was considered the primary concern in COVID.
Yeah.
And of course, we had to consider death, but not in isolation, you know, because so many people with long COVID, so many people with brain fog, so many people with ongoing new complications. And I think we're going to see a lot more autoimmune diseases and, you know, a lot of things happening to people as a consequence of COVID. And we might say we know very little about COVID, but we know a lot about serious viral illnesses.
Yeah.
And the same principles are going to apply. But there's too much emphasis on mortality. And AFib, I should say to people, I'm not a medical doctor, but I know of AFib in the context of risk for dementia.
Yeah.
And AFib can affect various aspects of your well-being, including your brain health, and increases your risk for developing stroke, which I presume you're probably alluding to. Somebody might just suddenly get a stroke. But also, and stroke increases your risk of dementia, but AFib also increases your risk of developing dementia, even if you've never had a stroke. As far as I understand it, you can have like little mini, it's like death by a thousand cuts often with these things, is that it's all these tiny little sort of, like, every time you have a flu, your brain takes a hit, do you know? And those things can pile up and ultimately affect your ability. So AFib is very serious.
Yeah, the good way to think about AFib from the perspective of your listeners is that instead of your heart beating nice and synchronously, where you have the blood flow going from different chambers of the heart in a nice orderly fashion, you have turbulent blood. And if your blood is turbulent because it's not in a nice sort of orderly fashion, it becomes sticky because all those factors smash in together. And so what can happen is you get these micro thrombi that can, like you said, go to your brain. They can also go to your intestines. They can go to anywhere and lodge themselves. And that can cause ischemia or lack of blood flow. And that's what can cause a multitude of issues that I was obviously very worried about.
Yeah, and being a medical doctor, you are aware of those things. But also that sticky blood that you talk about, that's been a feature of many people infected with COVID. The blood seemed to just have got very sticky. And that's why a lot of people, you know, had stroke or kind of brain issues. But of course, you see, as I say, your heart is a pump that services your brain. And if that pump's not working properly, you know, your brain is going to be affected. So you changed your diet. And I, you know, I mean, we hear lots of these stories. At the moment, what I'm kind of working on in terms of a next book is, you know, talking about manifesting your desires, but really from a scientific perspective, what it is inside your brain that does that. And a lot of these books that I'm reading around that, you know, they say, oh, if you do this, this happens. And you've just got to believe it. And you've just got to have faith and trust in it. And what I like about your story is the scientist in you, the medic in you. I mean, I think you talk about why you think the vegetables. I think it was that you thought, well, maybe you had a nutritional deficiency that you didn't know about. Or maybe you didn't have enough roughage.
The reason why I talk about that is because I'm often asked, and I will often ask myself, okay, the question is, okay, you made all these changes, how, like, what was the mechanism behind why that improved something that we haven't really made the connection with, atrial fibrillation? And so postulating what those might be, like you said, it could be I was harboring a deficiency in one of the micronutrients that I didn't have enough, and that wasn't picked up by the standard panel of bloods that we have in the NHS, like magnesium or vitamin zinc, or iron, all those different things. We don't tend to look for them. And also the ranges in which we look for them as well are pretty extreme. So to be classified as deficient for vitamin D, for example, you have to be sub 20, which I think is quite low. And actually, we should be looking at optimal levels, not just what is just classified as a deficiency.
And again, that's that thing in medicine, is they're ruling out disease instead of trying to optimize health. Exactly. Now, say vitamin D, for an example, would be a difference. So I get prescribed vitamin D, you know, because my levels are low. And as my GP puts it, I think you'll benefit from vitamin D, Sabina. Yeah. You know, whereas I've always been anemic, and then it's, no, you actually need iron because, you know, you have anemia, but you can get that from your food too. You know, it doesn't have to be through a supplement. But I do think part of that is, I remember I used to tutor, you may have had one in the NHS, but I used to tutor medical students. So I tutored them on behavioral science, and they just thought it was woo-woo, you know, you know,
really?
They, you know, anyway, and it's not woo-woo, you know, it's serious science, but they were interested in looking at the molecular level of everything and the biochemistry and everything. And I remember even asking questions, you know, what aspects of behavior do you think would influence health? And these really intelligent kids sitting there going, you know, and I go, how about exercise?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How about eating? How about sleep? Oh, yeah. Okay. Sorry, but what about the molecules? You know, like, what about? Yeah. So it's important to do both, but it's funny. And a lot of doctors don't. They get so focused. And I do think that a lot is to do with the training. Yeah. So again, I was delighted to read that you're working on, among many things, on, correct me if I'm wrong, like a nutritional module for young doctors.
Totally, yeah. So it's something called Culinary Medicine, which is a nonprofit inspired really by the Americans who have been doing culinary medicine in medical schools for the last 15 years or so. And basically what we do is, myself and a number of other people in the team, we teach medical students how to cook.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As well as giving them the tools about how to enact behavior change in a clinical setting. And we do that with the help of a registered dietitian that leads the class, a professional chef, where we actually get them teaching practical skills. And then we have a family meal afterwards, which is where we get to discuss, okay, what are the nuances of nutrition? What are the questions they have? People have loads of questions about nutrition, even, you know, at a young age. We all do. We're all fascinated with food. And we also get to talk about the skepticism around nutrition, you know, how effective can it be? And what are the cumulative effects with nutrition and pharmaceuticals and other lifestyle changes? Also, the practicality of instituting significant changes in a clinical environment when you've got such little time with your patients, you know, an averaging 8 minutes patient in general practice. So all this stuff really comes out, and it's been wonderful to see. UCL are the only medical school in Europe that have culinary medicine as part of their compulsory education now, which is, you know, an amazing step forward. We've been working with them for 2 years, even throughout the pandemic. We switched everything from in-person teaching at Westminster Kingsway to remote, but we're going back to in-person teaching now, which I think is super, super, because, you know, it's hard to do remote knife skills, for example, on Zoom. But there are a number of other medical schools like Bristol that do specialty choice modules now with us, with culinary medicine. And hopefully a lot more medical schools are going to buy into this idea that they should be training their students in culinary medicine, because it's you know, foundational practice.
Yeah, there's a lot of training. I do think the whole model needs a bit of a revamp. You were talking about lifestyle medicine. I'm also a huge fan of social prescribing. And I think that's where some of the answer lies, in that, okay, yes, you know, 8 minutes per patient, it's a very short period of time. A lot of, for example, older patients are often going in for sheer company. You know, a lot of visit around depression. There's some fabulous work done in Scotland. I remember speaking at an event in Perth in Scotland for the equivalent of our HICWA, which is the health authority, you know, monitoring. But actually, you know, where they literally had a team of people. So basically, you know, they would come in and say, actually, do you know what? You know, widowed men. That's something I want to bring up on nutrition as well. Widowed men coming in, you know, and generally speaking, and a lot of widowed people being prescribed antidepressants to, I mean, I remember doing my research, my PhD, you know, what medications are you taking, any medications? And so many of them would say no. But we would also say to them, when we do the face-to-face, will you bring in any meds? You know, and then you look and you kind of go, you're this medication, which would be an antidepressant, and you can be on that. Oh yeah, and my doctor put me on that when my husband died, and he said, sure, there's no point in, you know, I may as well kind of stay on it. And you're going, it's a fucking antidepressant, excuse my French, but that is acting on your central nervous system. That could be affecting your cognitive ability. I actually can't use them in the study anyway. And you'd kind of go, well, hold on a second, she was on that for grief, which is questionable in the first place. You know, helping people through grief, it's a process. You need to feel that pain, you know, and kind of get through it. Some instances it's required. But I sort of said to her, when did your husband die? Like 10 years ago. You know, and you kind of go, this is absolute madness. But this fabulous doctor that I heard speak, so what they would do is prescribe the local men's shed. Or, you know, suggest, you know, what sport did you ever play? Oh, there's a tennis club, whatever. And then he had a team of people who didn't have to be qualified. And I say a team, maybe there was one or two, but they were to help the person then afterwards. So the person didn't have to go off and find the men's shed. They would then say, this is the men's shed. I'm going to introduce you to so-and-so, you know, and actually take what is often the hardest step. The first one, and kind of get them in there. And there's so many other ways that having people like that in now we're moving more certainly here anyway to that medical model where you have your chiropodist and your psychologist and your physiotherapist all in the same place. But we could have people that don't cost as much that could help immensely with that kind of thing. And there could be a cooking one because I did research a number of years ago, and actually we were shortlisted for an award for it, in with the big Microsofts and all the rest. And basically we did a study called Relate, and I was interested in developing it as a model that could become a social model, a sort of a pay it forward social model, but also a model that could be introduced by governments supported. So essentially what we did was we matched volunteers. So we advertised in the newspaper for people who self-identified as feeling lonely or socially isolated. And then we matched them with people who were interested in volunteering in the community. Now, it was a pairing. It was not like we had to train the volunteers. You are not here to help this individual. This is a match. The idea being that in a few years' time, perhaps if you need it, you've done your bit, someone does it for you. So essentially, we matched them together. We developed a little cookbook. The basics, exactly that, how to cut up, you know, vegetable, how to boil an egg, you know, and essentially what they did was together, they chose meal recipes out of the book. They selected the food. They met for once a week for 90 minutes. They prepared the meal together. They ate it together and supposedly cleared up together. We had some volunteers come back. He never washes up. And then others who became friends for life after it. But the interesting thing we found was, now, we had advertised in the Times, okay, so it was not lower socioeconomic status. This was essentially a trial. Ultimately, we were hoping maybe to get funding to do a clinical trial. But so that was the socioeconomic status, well-educated people. We found that almost 27% of mainly, most of our participants were men, actually. 27% of them were malnourished or borderline malnourished. Now, that didn't mean they were underweight, but they were doing things like eating sandwiches or eating meals for one or not bothering to eat. So I will always say that food is not just about sustenance. Mm-hmm. It is about social contact and interaction. And what research shows, what the literature shows, and what was reflected in our own research was that when you share a meal with somebody else, when you enjoy that, you actually take more nutrients in.
Yeah.
You'll eat more food. You'll eat nicer food. You care more about the food. And I think that's something really important that I do it myself. Anybody, even if you are in a relationship, say, oh, well, it's just me. Oh, I'll just have toast and this, yeah. Or, you know, so you have to value yourself if you are on your own. But also, I think there is huge value. I mean, what sparked our study in a sense was we started to hear that instead of delivering, it was in the UK, actually. And instead of, you know, meals on wheels, they had made a decision to be more efficient. Instead of delivering meals on wheels every day, they decided they were delivering 7 meals and that would save a whole load of money. Your weekly meals in one stop. And I was going, but you're missing the point. That contact of someone just calling the door to give you a meal could be the only contact for that individual.
Absolutely.
And that just doesn't apply to older people.
Yeah,
so food is how we evolved into who we are, learning how to cook. You know, fire helped our cerebral cortex expand and we learned around food.
Mm.
And that scares me in a way as well. I'm totally pro technology, totally for it. But in balance with a life where we should at least as families be eating meals around a table, because you can learn. We mustn't move too far away from that campfire.
One of the reasons why I think the Mediterranean diet is so effective, because the Mediterranean diet isn't just about the collection of different ingredients, which just for the listeners is made up of largely legumes, mostly plants, colorful, local, seasonal, as well as whole grains and minimal processed meats, if no processed items at all, and minimal animal products. It's actually...
And oil from olive oil.
And oil from extra virgin olive oil,
your fats from olive oil.
Good fats, whole fats. So with all those anti-inflammatory benefits and omega-3 from oily fish. But it's also about the way in which the Mediterraneans tend to eat as well, which is around the table without distraction. And I think perhaps one of the reasons why, you know, we have a French paradox where they smoke more than us, they drink more than us, yet they have less disease than us. And if you go there, they have a good hour for lunch. You know, they are not rushed when they're eating. Yeah. And I think that has something to do with it. Maybe not everything, but certainly something.
Yeah, I know there's certainly from our perspective, because obviously from a brain health perspective and, you know, in terms of reducing risk for developing dementia, adopting a Mediterranean diet has the best evidence. And certainly in my first instance, I was going, well, there's the social engagement, there's the challenging level, and that is definitely there. Although there have been studies that sort of separate out those things. But I definitely agree with you. There is that added bonus and we sort of need. I mean, I remember actually on my honeymoon, it was my first time really experiencing people eating. I mean, I'd been on girls' holidays, but a honeymoon was different, you know, and we'd gone somewhere nice, went out for meals and stuff like that. But I remember people eating in the restaurant. There was, must have been 8 courses in a sense. These weren't big courses. Like I remember one of the courses was just plates of figs because it was my first time ever seeing a fig. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah,
you know, growing up in Ireland when I did, like it was meat and 2 veg. Like you really, there was a very limited diet. Like vegetables were carrots and potatoes. And obviously potatoes are just sugar. They're starch. They're a carbohydrate. They're not a vegetable, you know. And I think there's a lot of Irish people today who still go, what do you mean? It's not a vegetable. It's not really, you know, it's not a beneficial vegetable. But I remember seeing them and they talked for hours and even on the beach. And I love that on the beach, you see multi-generational food sharing and conversation and then napping in an afternoon, which is another thing that is sort of, you know, there's health benefits. It's a cultural thing. And there is interesting studies from Greece where because of the tourism industry, a group of wherever, and I forgive me because I can't remember the exact place, etc. You know yourself, you have thousands of studies. But basically what they found was the nap essentially sort of became eradicated because they needed to open during siesta time if they were going to earn a living, you know, selling food. Okay. Ultimately, what happened, long story short, was there was an increase in heart disease, heart attacks, heart conditions in the men. I must look up the study, but absolutely, because certainly with sleep, we have a natural dip in alertness mid-afternoon. We all try and overcome it. A great way to overcome it, folks, if you're listening, is actually to go for a run or take aerobic exercise at lunchtime. It actually will sharpen your alertness and your ability to learn and focus and pay attention and actually remember better. But there's nothing to say that there are some cultures who still do it. And I often say to people, if you're missing sleep, the night before, you can use napping prophylactically or to make up a sleep loss.
Yeah.
But you've got to make sure it's only either for about 10 minutes or 90 minutes. Otherwise, if it's 10 minutes, you get a nice little benefit. If you go 40 minutes or whatever, you wake up mid-cycle and you wake up sleep drunk, feeling far worse. I wanted to ask you something, because you're not a vegetarian or whatever, and you will eat meat occasionally. Most of your recipes, though, don't have meat. You do have some. I saw that on your app. So you have vegan, vegetarian, and pescatarian is what you have. So there's two things I want to ask you about there. One of them being, what are your feelings around veganism from a health perspective? I certainly have some concerns about it. I have some concerns about it from a brain health perspective. And secondly, from, and the same applies, I suppose, to vegetarianism in that regard. They are considered healthful, but they are only helpful if you ensure that you are getting all of the nutrients. And I know so many vegetarians who have crap diets, like they just eat loads of bread and pasta and whatever. So what's your feelings? I mean, I know there's certainly been some research around dangers of veganism for young children and development.
Yeah, with regards to diet, so you're right, a mixture of different foods. I do eat animal products. I treat them as luxury items. And the reason why I include them in my diet is because they are rich sources of nutrients that are very hard to get from a, or impossible to get from a purely plant-based diet and a vegetarian diet as well. And those are the common ones, omega-3, B vitamins, particularly B12, as well as a complex of B vitamins. Iron you can get from plants, from legumes, nuts,
and dark green vegetables,
but people's absorption can change from person to person based on their pre-existing issues.
And vitamin age, B12 absorption changes dramatically with age.
Yeah, definitely. And that's also signifying our loss of microbial diversity as well, because the B12 is actually produced from certain microbes, and we've lost that in the soil. And so I hear you about some concerns, particularly when it comes to children and developmental stages with regard to lack of omega-3 and B vitamins. And yeah, I mean, you can get zinc and stuff from other sources, but those are the two that come to mind. And I know, like, we don't necessarily recommend that for pediatric nutrition, but comparing what the general state of affairs is with diet as it pertains to people who don't follow a particular, low plant-based regime, vegan diets can be great for those people as long as they're supplemented. And I think most people know what the supplementation should be these days. And if they don't, I highly recommend you look it up as well, because you don't want to be at loss. It's a strange one with diet, isn't it? Because it's mixed in with like a moral imperative to do something. Yes. I do respect that from adults who choose that way of life. And it's something that I think ever since I got a puppy, I've been reestablishing my relationship with animals in general, because it's hard. Because
you got a puppy, what did you get?
Yeah, I got it. Well, what's she's not even a puppy now. She's like almost 2 years old, but she still looks still like a puppy.
Yeah. That's still a puppy. What kind of dog is she?
She's a Cavapoo.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
okay.
And she's about yay big.
We call them mongrels.
Oh, really?
It just meant any dogs that wasn't a thoroughbred, where they just mixed breeds. Yeah. So when we were kids, that's exactly what it was.
I mean, she's great. And like, I've never had a pet before, and like, take her out and like care for her. And she looks like a little lamb. And like, so it's that like difficult relationship, because the only reason why we don't eat dogs is because of they're not bred for that. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Other countries do. Well, and there are pets, and we do have, there's a very particular relationship. I have three dogs. I used to have five dogs. I actually highly recommend anybody who is feeling isolated or lonely. You saw that in lockdown.
Oh,
I feel
great.
Really bad though, but the amount of them who are giving their dogs back, that's horrible.
That's terrible.
But Also, the companionship. I work from home most of the time. I write. And I mean, they genuinely give you unconditional love. Like, yeah, they genuinely, no matter what, they are just wonderful. Yeah, I mean, I was vegetarian. I turned vegetarian when I was teen and was vegetarian for several years. Now, when I was a teen, it's a very long time ago. And as I said, there really wasn't even options of food. Like, I got married around, what was I, 24, whatever. And like that, that was the first time I saw a fig. And yeah, actually, even in Dublin, we really didn't even have restaurants. They only sort of started to come in. It sounds like I was born in the dark ages, but people forget how much things have changed in a period of time.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was not a healthy vegetarian, you know, and then sort of ended up. Again, like that, a few years ago, I stopped eating meat, particularly. Again, for me, I became vegetarian again because of animals, you know, just loving animals, etc. Yeah. Then I went back, and you can manage. You can put a Chinese wall in your head and kind of differentiate out. I was on holiday one time in the States, and we were staying with some people, and they would actually go out fishing, and I was kind of, oh, the fish, you know, but I would eat fish, you know, and he had a rule, never eat anything you wouldn't be prepared to kill yourself.
Absolutely.
And I think that's kind of a good rule, and I would not be prepared to kill any animal.
Yeah.
Most recently, it's the pigs, because I just saw this video about a pig. Wherever he was listening, you know, there was loud noises, or he was rescued from somewhere, you know, and he would cry every time there was a loud noise or a bang. And then, you know, you kind of go, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So, you'll kind of have me, you know, again. And then there's the argument also that we are animals ourselves, and, you know, we evolved. And people say, well, we have choice now. We do have choice, but it comes with an artificial, as you just said, you have to take supplements.
Yeah.
So that isn't. And also then, I wonder as well what's gone into the trials that have developed those supplements. I'm sure they've been based on animal research at some point along the way, you know, so like it's very difficult.
I mean, to be a pure like plant-based, or, you know, pure vegan is probably the most appropriate word, it's very hard to avoid anything that has brought some harm to some living thing.
And your medication often
Absolutely.
Has gelatin or something in it, you know, that
Even the testing process has gone through animal research in a lot of cases. So, you know, for that aside, it's hard. I mean, my perspective on this, the optimal diet includes animal products. I think it's quite hard to argue against that, actually. But with how diverse diet is in terms of its influence on the environment, the moral arguments, our psychology around eating, the cultural elements, all that different stuff, you know, I can understand why people would want to go plant-based. It's not a bad diet, but it certainly needs to be supplemented. And everyone from the plant-based space, whether they be nutritionists or doctors, would agree that it definitely needs to be supplemented to be optimal. And so we run into that sort of course of, is this a privileged diet, and is this actually achievable for the majority of people? And
masses,
I would say exactly right now, it probably isn't.
And certainly not with our education level in schools around.
Exactly.
And that's where I hear danger levels, you know, people seeing things like being vegan as a almost a cool thing to be
as
well.
A cool thing.
You know, it's a cool thing to be. And you know, we have Vegan January, you know what I mean? And it, you know, it's kind of taking that momentum, and that's good, provided it comes with the knowledge that you must, there are various micro and macronutrients that you must get elsewhere that you can't get from that diet. I want to ask you something. You've been really generous with your time, you know, having tried some of your recipes myself and some of the things that you do. You know, I actually have a friend, and she has always just been so careful with the food that she eats in that regard. And she came to mind, my dogs, you know, one day last week. And I know actually she came to visit me, but she sort of came armed with her own food. Do you know that?
Right?
And it was lovely, because then I got to eat her beautiful food, and she had roasted squash, and but she would always have her sprouts, you know, she would always leave her sprouts. And I think I remember reading you do that, or in one of your cookbooks, which I do have here. Where have I left it? Probably outside my barricade where I can't get it. But she is maybe a year or two younger than me, and I would say that she probably looks as she did when I met her first in her 30s.
Oh, wow.
You know, and her hair, and, you know, her skin. And I mean, she's a stunning woman anyway. But I do think, you know, her lifestyle and those choices, and she never drank much alcohol. In fact, I don't think she really drinks alcohol. She might have a glass of wine or two.
Yeah.
And she would do yoga and meditation. And it really does. Unfortunately, you know, I did the wild child thing. Like, I started smoking at 12 or 13, and, you know, tried the few drugs and things. Thankfully, I gave up cigarettes by, you see, this is what amazed me as well. And I hope you don't mind saying, you're about 35, 34, 35.
I'm 36, 37 this year. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. But that's still really young for everything that you have achieved. Oh, I remember thanks. Someone telling me also that if you give up smoking by the time you're 35, you can kind of negate
yeah.
what you've done. So actually, that's when I did it. But I still have the lines.
Okay.
It's such a bad thing to ever, ever take up. But for me, it was kind of the boldness of it. That's funny. I had very strict and you know, so many factors influence our choices in food or any behavior we choose to do. I know I was always a very good child, the perfectionist child, did really well at school, but I also had very restrictive religious parenting that I wasn't allowed to do. And it was very much be seen and not heard. It was very much that. So like my father would have been in his 40s when I was born. So even though my generation should have been more modern, my parents weren't, sort of thing. And yeah, I think I smoked to be bold. Do you know what I mean? To kind of get that release, which is really stupid. If you're going to rebel, folks, do something that isn't going to damage you. Be a vegan. Yeah, if you're going to rebel, do something like that. Now, I wanted to ask you, because I really do always intend to eat. My favorite restaurant that I go to when I'm staying in London is actually a vegan restaurant. I just love trying and tasting. Oh, love it. Yeah. It's not a sit-down restaurant. It's one of those where you go and you can fill your plate. And I just love it because I can try all the different foods. And if I could afford someone, that would be the second thing. Our first thing, possibly before the head massage, would be someone to cook beautiful, healthy, well-prepared foods for me.
Yeah.
I go through phases. Sometimes I'm really, really good. Sometimes I'm terrible. My son now is a doctor, and he, the same as you, his health was suffering and the food and the diet. Now himself and his girlfriend on a Sunday, they batch cook their meals for the week. He actually came to stay with me last week and he brought his meals with him. They were prepared. Now I gave him pizza when he came and he missed it, but then he gave me one of his dinners the next day. It was really nice. It was lovely. But what I want to ask you, very long-winded in a way, is because I've moved to the country now, I don't have immediate access to a supermarket where I can get my fresh veg. Mm. Ideally now, I'm now on 8 acres beside a lake. It's incredible. Amazing. I've moved here for my health and well-being and all the rest, really. And ultimately, I would like to, in my ideal me world, I would like to actually have my own vegetable garden where there's only myself and my husband. So if I buy a bag of rocket lettuce, it goes off before I can eat it all. So ideally, I want to be able to have lettuce that I can just pick a few leaves. My father used to have a glass house and we'd go out and pick the tomatoes warm. That smell. Oh, you don't get that from the supermarket.
Yeah.
The smell of tomatoes that you've just picked off a leaf and then you have for your dinner. And my dad would grow flowers that we could eat. And I would ideally do that, but that's not happening yet. I'm still coping with moving house and all that. Are frozen vegetables as good? Are the nutrients locked in frozen veg?
Yeah, so frozen veg is actually surprisingly a good source of nutrition because of that very reason, in that they're frozen at source, so they haven't had that much of a chance to degrade. And actually, when you transport them, they're less likely to become nutrient depleted compared to fresh. So sometimes you can do some comparisons on peas and sweet corn, and actually you'll find that the frozen is actually a lot better using certain parameters. So I use frozen veg all the time as a like something to bulk up a stir fry, to add to a casserole.
I use it for soups when I'm good, because it takes 5 minutes to make a soup that is full of veg. I have a soup maker, but I actually don't even have to use that.
The
basic thing is, if you have onions, just slice up an onion in a pan. If you want to throw any seasoning in it, go for it.
Yeah.
Stock cube. You can use your veggie stock cube. I'm sure it's better to make your own stock. Don't have time for that.
No, I don't.
Throw that in. I throw frozen peas in, endive beans or whatever. Yeah. I'll also, because I do eat chicken, we generally always have a cooked chicken in the house because we spoil our dogs. They get chicken mixed in with their...
Oh, wow. Nice.
And there's always one, so I chop some off and throw it in. And in fact, I think I'm going to try and be good again today. And I think I'll have that because it's delicious.
Yeah.
Like, I love it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just you forget.
they're really good sources of nutrition. And, you know, frozen, just such a lovely, convenient item. I also have frozen fruit as well. So frozen berries, frozen blackcurrants, frozen blackberries, like they're all great. And they lock in a lot of those polyphenols that we know are so good for brain health as well as cardiac health as well.
But anyway, you have just been amazing. First of all, tell us where people can buy your app or download your app. And then also, I see you have your Doctor's Kitchen on the shelf there. Oh, yeah. I actually have a copy of that book as well. Lovely recipes in it. You have two other books. Like, yeah, you're only 36, for goodness sake. I wrote my first book in 2019.
Yeah, so you can get the app from the App Store. It's available on iPhone. Just look up The Doctor's Kitchen. It'll be there. And yeah, the books you can find on thedoctorskitchen.com. And we have a newsletter. We share recipes there every week. There's obviously the podcast and the Instagram.
Oh, and the podcast. Yes, the podcast is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, which you've kindly been a guest on as well. It was lovely. That was really well received.
Oh, I was just an absolute honor to be a guest on it. I was delighted to be asked. And just did want to ask you that. So I read in some interview that you did that, you know, when you saw the benefits, you just wanted to share them. And that resonates with me. When I found research on brain health and stuff, I just wanted to shout from the rooftops, because I just said, yeah, everybody needs to know this. You must know this. Because someone said to me once, I said, oh, I'd love to do this and that, and, you know, really sort of make a business out of this. And someone who actually is a real entrepreneur worth millions said to me, Sabina, you are not an entrepreneur, you're an evangelist. kind of makes sense. You know, I just kind of want to tell people about these things. But you said you really started off with this blog. I presume it was a video blog.
Yeah.
And how did you go from that to this huge podcast, to being on the BBC regularly, just exploding in a really short period of time? What happened? Did someone famous see you?
No, it was very strange and non-calculated. I mean, like, the reason why I started the Doctor's Kitchen in the first place was really to try and help patients eat better, and I wanted to save time. So I started doing videos on YouTube of how to make oats and how to make like small meals and stuff and what the benefits were. I just wanted to share that with patients. And then I
that was 2015.
Yeah, 2015, exactly. So, you know, 7 years ago now, or 6.5 years. And I just started from that. And I was working in Australia at the time. And when I got back, I got approached by a literary agent very early on. And then I had obviously, you know, meetings, and they wanted to do TV and stuff. And they actually suggested that I do a podcast. So I started my podcast relatively early on in 2017, and I just fell in love with it. Like yourself, you know, the privilege to interview incredible people who are experts in their field and have genuine conversations that will change people's perception of their lives. Amazing. And I'm in a very privileged position, and I'm very grateful for it.
You are indeed. But it is funny, I started my podcast because my literary agent says you need to do a podcast, you know. And I suppose I have a background in television and film.
Exactly.
And, you know,
yeah,
took the hind legs off a donkey, so I loved it. I had wanted to do one in the past, you know, had sort of half entertained the idea, but it's lovely in and of itself just to do it, even if nothing else came from it. But folks, you know, download that app. You get a 14-day free trial period. If apps are not your thing, listen to the podcast. If podcasts aren't your thing, there's the books. You know what? Even just go on to Instagram. Like, honestly, Rupi's Instagram is a bit like, it's food porn, but healthy food porn.
healthy food porn. That's the way. That's the way I like to describe it.
Healthy food porn. Thank you so much, Rupi.
I really appreciate it.
I do like to finish on asking my guests to share just one thing about surviving and or thriving in life.
Yeah, I think for me, like I said right at the start, I think actually having an affirmation every day that you read that's personal to you, you don't necessarily need to share it with anyone. Honestly, I think that's actually one of the best things that I've done. You know, I could talk about nutrition. I could talk about adding one more fruit, vegetable, nut or seed every meal time. You know, I could do all those different things. But actually, when it comes to thriving and surviving, I think your mindset is so important. So if you can book in 30 seconds with yourself in the morning, and I think it's quite important to have it in the morning, and affirm to yourself, you know, some confidence boosting tips or a little mantra, if you like, that stays with you throughout the day and you can commit to that every day. For me, it's been really game changing when it comes to going through times where you do need to thrive and you need to, you know,
you need to survive there. Actually just exactly. Push through. So for people who aren't familiar with that sort of terminology of affirmation, because it's in that sort of zone really around meditation, and some people don't see that as part, it may not be familiar.
Yeah,
I know the word, you can look it up in the dictionary, but what really is at the core of an affirmation?
Yeah, so I'll give you the example of mine, and it's a couple of sentences that I read out loud to myself every morning. And it says along the lines of, Rupee, I address myself, you're doing a very challenging thing and you will get through it. Remember, persistence is key, consistency is king, and you will achieve everything you want to one step at a time. And so just that I read every single morning. And every time I listen to that, it gives me a little, you know, pep talk. It gives me a little prep in the morning. And it doesn't have to be for, you know, if you're doing a business or you're running an app, which is what I'm doing and which is what I'm sort of channeling that energy for. It can be from, you know, the simple day-to-day tasks. You know, sometimes a challenge for somebody is getting out of their house and going for a walk every day. Sometimes it's parenting. Sometimes it's the job that they don't like as much, or they're looking to move to a new one. You know, everyone has their own unique challenges. And that's why I think having an affirmation that's personal to you, that really resonates with you, is something that would be really pivotal, I think, for people on a day to day.
You know, and you've just reminded me, like, it doesn't have to take that form of first thing in the morning is really good. And I always say, you know, smile first thing in the morning. It really sets you up for the day. Yeah. But actually, I've just realized my husband has never meditated in his life, wouldn't be his cup of tea, but always had a great self-confidence in himself that, say, I wouldn't have had. And I'm going back donkey's years since we were young, you know, when we got married first. And at the moment, he keeps saying to me, stop being so down on yourself because you've gained weight, because I still haven't lost it. And that's so much part of who I am. Yeah. I've never been an overweight person. Do you know that kind of way? Anyway, well, what he would do every morning, and it's just something that he has done naturally, and I reckon from that has stemmed his natural self-confidence. He would get dressed in the morning, he'd put on it, and he'd say, God, you look good. do you know what I mean?
Brilliant.
You know, like he would tell himself, you know, something, oh, you're looking sharp, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And I think he did it from a sense of humor perspective, but your brain listens.
Totally.
That's the thing. What you say to yourself, the stories you tell yourself, whether they're affirmations, whether they're repetitive thoughts, they make your reality. There's actually, and this is going to sound like woo-woo, but there is no independent reality. It is the story that you tell yourself. That's what your brain then creates, because it can't take in all the data that's around you to create an actual physical reality. It will be attuned to the things you tell it to be attuned to. So it will be attuned to the fact that I feel, oh my God, my belly, these are tighter, you know, because I'm tuning to that. Whereas actually, if I let that go and tune to something else, I'd probably be far happier each day, and may actually, the weight may fall off. Because often when you focus on that, you go, oh, I'm hungry, oh, I need to eat, you know, when actually you're not really. Yeah. Anyway, a pleasure as always.
My
Thank
pleasure,
you
honestly.
So
it was so
much.
Lovely.
And you, I'm so much, I stole loads of your time, but when I have you.
So good.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope that you found something in this episode that will help you to survive and thrive in life. For me, it's the simple practical tip to pack my freezer with frozen vegetables. It's been a game changer for me, especially as currently I'm in the midst of renovating my new home, trying to get our 8-acre garden under control, on top of writing, speaking, podcasting, and contributing to TV and radio. Knowing that I always have the ingredients for a tasty stir fry or a simple soup has helped me to avoid turning to unhealthy snacks or stodgy carbs. My name is Sabina Brennan, and you have been listening to Superbrain, the podcast for everyone with a brain. You can follow me on Instagram at Sabina Brennan and Twitter at Sabina_Brennan.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.